to Art of Advisory. Today is September 25th. And the reason why I'm mentioning the dates, which we usually don't, is because we actually have an event coming up in roughly about a month. And Kirk and I are both preparing our sessions for it. And we wanted to use this this venue to kind of like sort of brainstorm what some of our ideas are. Full disclosure, we're teaching things that we have taught before and things that the both of us consider, we're considered seasoned professionals in this topic, but we always want to bring something new, something innovative, and these type of brainstorming sessions help quite a bit. So, hey, Kirk, how are you? Welcome back.
Hey, Hector, how you doing? I appreciate you admitting that you've taught your topic before. I'm teaching a brand new topic, how to determine the best hourly rate for your practice. I'm really looking forward to that. That's going to be a great session.
Oh, so a nice change from the good old value pricing. We're going to go back to hourly now?
Yep, yep.
Well, that should be challenging.
So as we were talking before the show, I understand you now have a side relationship. You want to tell us about that and come out of the closet?
Yes, so absolutely. So Blair Enns is one of my heroes, kind of like Ron Baker is also one of my heroes on the value pricing space. I interviewed him last week. So check out that episode. It would be episode 33. I believe it was the last week. It was the 18th. So September 18th, episode 33, Blair Enns, E-N-N-S. Check out that episode. I think it was fantastic. Kirk wasn't on, so that's probably why it was so good. No, but it was really, really good. Blair's an expert in pricing for creative firms, mostly for like marketing, advertising, and creative type firms. And what's interesting is he's the guy that teaches them how to sell. So you got the most brilliant minds in marketing charging millions of dollars to these huge companies for very creative work, and they're not creative enough to come up with good pricing strategies. And Blair is kind of like that gateway to that. So I think it's just a fascinating person to talk to. So I'm totally in love with him.
So Hector.
Yeah.
All right. Top three takeaways. Once you get past the man crush.
Yeah.
Top three takeaways from your interview with Blair.
Yeah. So number one, I would say, I love the fact that he created this book called Win Without Pitching Manifesto. And he structured it sort of like commandments, you know, like we will do this, we will not do this. And I believe that all industries need this. I believe that even the accounting industry, especially some of the more modern firms that want to do things differently, that sort of thing. I think we actually need that. We need some sort of manifesto to ground us in the core values and ideals in which we want to take our business towards and who we focus in and how we work. I think that we all need, I think we absolutely all need that. So I actually like the fact that he has a whole book around that. And we talked about that briefly. That would be takeaway number one. That would be one of my life missions in the next year or so, is to create my own company credo or my own company manifesto, which will mimic a lot from what I learned from Blair. Number two, the key takeaway, and that's part of our conversation and part of one specific episode from his podcast, Two Bobs, which they talk about how successful people talk about money with ease. And this is just a really interesting topic, because we are usually taught or raised that talking about money is rude. You know, when we talk about monies and quantities and who has money, who doesn't have money, how much things cost, funny, after you bought them is rude. So you could always talk to someone about how much a car is, but if after you bought it, you can't talk about how much you paid for it. It's the craziest thing. We have these really strange taboos around money. And one of the things that he brings out of the open and kind of argues for is that successful people can talk about money with ease. And that translates into business when you're, you know, giving your price or quoting your services or talking tangibly about what the client could possibly get back from their investment by hiring you with real numbers, and also talking about how much money you would pay them back or give them a money back guarantee if you don't perform. All these numbers or this money conversations, when people speak about them with ease, I think it also inspires others, right, to talk about it as well, because you want, I think you want your customers talking about money with you with ease as well. I would assume that's a generic strategy that we should be thinking about, right? Because obviously if your clients are holding back and they're not talking about money with you, then the conversation becomes awkward later on when you actually need them to write a check, right? So I actually thought that was pretty interesting. I think that we can, you and I could both spend a whole episode talking about own experiences with conversations about money with friends, colleagues, customers, all that stuff. And the number three takeaway, which I thought it was just really interesting, is his take is that the narrower you go, the more specialized you go, the more you say no to other things, and the more you sort of pigeonhole yourself into one really small area of practice, the more money is there waiting for you, the more potential profits. And that's something that I think a lot of people have said that before, but I like the way he explained it, you know, and he used some fantasy movie analogies, which was fun. But the way he explained it, I think it will start resonating with others. And that's absolutely true. The more you specialize, the more you become better at less things, the easier that people will have to figure out whether or not you are an expert at it, the easier it is to market yourself, and the easier it is for a global community to find you. So I would say those are the three summarized takeaways.
I like the one about talking about money. I've always said that the money conversation is not over until you've been paid in full. And until that happens, you still have some conversation to resolve. It's interesting. I haven't watched the interview yet, so Blair may have commented on this, or I may be going in a totally different direction. But, you know, you think back 50 years ago, even 30, 20 years ago, you know, the idea that an increasing majority of the U.S. population would be self-employed, would be freelancers. People would be leaving corporate America, quote, and going out on their own, wasn't really part of what we were expecting. Now that's norm. And, you know, statistics are showing that, you know, anywhere from 10 to 20 years, that half of the workforce is going to be self-employed. So I think a lot of these ideas about being polite about money came from our personal interactions, right? We were taught not to ask what somebody's salary is, right? Or not to ask how much, you know, as a kid, you know, kids, when they're born, they don't have any of this preconceived idea that talking about money's bad. So they'll turn around at the dinner table with guests and go, "Dad, how much money you got in your bank account?" Right? Or, "Dad, how much did we pay for this house?" Or all those kind of things, right? That are kind of taboo or considered rude or impolite to talk about. Well, those type of ideas don't transfer to business. It's actually the opposite. Not talking about money is rude in business. Why? Because business is based on money. It requires money, right? Money is typically changing hands in two different forms, right? One person's paying in currency to the other. Well, the person who's receiving currency is turning around and providing something of greater value back to the person who's paying them. So it's just weird that in my opinion, we've taken kind of what were these social taboos in our personal life and moved them into business. And I think that's been compounded because a lot more people are now running their own businesses, freelancers, et cetera. So the other thing, and I'd be curious to hear your opinion on this, is, you know, Blair is the first person that I ever heard stand up and say, "I price the customer first before we even talk about scope." And I find that really interesting. And in my opinion, that's a more advanced form of pricing. I agree it's the direction to go, but did he talk about that? And what was your impression?
We didn't talk about that. We were cut short by the gods of the 1 hour time frame.
Ah.
So yeah, I think it could have gone forever. I'm going to try to, I don't know, I'll send him a gift or something, see if he can come back and we'll spend another hour with him. I would love to pick his brain about so many things, but yeah, we didn't get a chance to talk about that. But I think
so. Just unpack it, just so that I'm not leaving people hanging. Blair says that in his first conversation with a customer, based on the questions he asks about their business and what they're wanting to achieve, he and this is, you know, at a top level, he's able to price them. And basically, what I think the way he would put it is, he says, "I decide on the price I want to receive to help that customer." based on the problem they're telling me they have and the type of business they have, their experience, revenue, et cetera, where they want to go, I price them there. And I don't even, you know, it doesn't matter to him that he hasn't determined the scope yet. That's the price he wants to receive. And so basically he decides on the price he wants to receive. And then, you know, he works if they essentially, he gives them a range usually, I think, although sometimes he might give them a number, but basically he just gets price out there early so that he doesn't waste another phone call with a customer if they're not comfortable with the price he wants to receive. Now, I think there's a couple of points there. Number one, he has gotten so confident with pricing that he has no problem quoting a price up front, not knowing the scope, because he trusts himself to make sure that he matches the scope up with the price later. But it's interesting. He's taking the same approach that Toyota has been taking with cars for years. They first determine what the market will pay for the car. And then they go to the engineers and they say, hey, we need you to build this car at this price, you know, and so we can make, and with this profit margin, essentially. And then they leave it up to the engineers to figure out how to build the thing where they can make a profit. So it's kind of interesting. He's taking the same approach. So, okay. And I would, the other comment I'd make, it's a very, to me, it's a more advanced form of pricing, but I think it's what we should be working toward.
I'm going to comment on that. And I really hope that we don't go down this rabbit hole and turn this episode into a full pricing conversation, but why not? I guess, you know, you're teaching value pricing in QuickBooks Connect in a month anyway, so this stuff will be relevant no matter what. So two comments. So first, you talked about the taboo of talking about money, and you mentioned talking about money with friends and customers. You know, you didn't talk about talking about money with employees, and that's a particular interesting topic, because I've gone through iterations of that in my own business where I've had employees in which I give them no exposure to, you know, our financials, like how we make money as a company. And there's another group of employees that I have given them full exposure to the financials. And I may have implemented one right and one wrong, but I've got really mixed results. Whereas I don't have enough information to tell you which route I prefer. For the sake of transparency, I wouldn't mind if they knew and understood that. But there's always this notion, and I have this issue with my customers too, with my small business clients, where they're all freaking out about, hey, I don't want the warehouse guy to know how much money I make. And I'm conflicted sometimes on the answer. Sometimes I agree, saying, you know, in the short term, I think that it avoids a lot of drama, especially if employees know how much each other make and that sort of thing. But in the long term, if you're an employee starting off in a company and you know that a manager makes three times as much as you, wouldn't that encourage that person to want to grow into that position? I mean, I'm just thinking out loud. Maybe that's, we can reserve a whole episode to this, because this is actually a big, this is one of the things that when I first heard Blair say this in the podcast and David, his co-host, I didn't pay much attention to it. And I've gone a second time around and listened to all podcast episodes. And the second time I heard it, it just really struck me on how bad I am talking about money. And when I say bad, I mean relatively. I think I'm great to talk. I'm great to talk about money compared with maybe, you know, everybody else in my family that's not an accountant, because money, it's a simple concept for me to talk about. But I think at the end of the day, I'm nervous wreck when it comes to discussing numbers with people. Even asking an employee, hey, how much money, you know, what are you aspiring to next year in terms of a raise? If you scale up and increase responsibilities, I'm scared that they'll say a number I can't afford or that sort of thing. So I think that that's a big topic, Kirk, and we probably should dedicate a whole episode to that.
Hector just meant was, Kirk, we're not going to change subjects and continue to talk about that. So he's basically telling me to limit my comments. So I'm going to limit it to this. The same thing that I say about the money conversation with a customer, I would apply that to the employer-employee relationship until you've been paid in full. And obviously, you know, an employee's not been paid in full. I think you would have to say the first paycheck or maybe the second. The money conversation's not over. I think the companies that have easier conversations with their employees about money are the ones who don't hide it, are the ones who share more. I'm not saying they open up the books and any employee can go and look at, you know, the accounts and see what's going on. But, and I'm not even necessarily saying they necessarily share salaries with one employee with another. That depends on your company culture. That's a culture decision, in my opinion. But when they advertise a job, they do say, here's the salary or here's the range. So in other words, they don't even get people applying that don't already know what the expectation is. And, you know, it's kind of taking Blair's approach the same, right? Blair says, you know what, before I get the scope, before we get too far down the road, I'm going to put the price out. Well, you can do the same thing on the employment side by putting it in the employment ad or just stating it in the first interview. Hey, I just want to make sure you understand you're applying for this position. It's going to start at this salary or this range. That way there's no misconception. What would be worse than to go through an entire interview process with an employee and you want them and then you find out, you know, they're thinking twice what you're thinking. So those would be my comments, and we can certainly devote another episode to that, but I can't just let you throw it out there and
We will. So let's transition to your value pricing. That was a joke, a sarcastic joke at the beginning. He's not talking about hourly fees in QuickBooks Connect. He's talking about value pricing. And let's transition to that. And there was a second comment that you made, which I think will be a perfect segue, where Kirk says that, Kirk said that Blair said that before he meets with a client, he has enough information, or he can infer or extrapolate enough information about the value that he's going to bring to the table. I would say more in terms of economic value, like how is that client going to get something out of what he does after he's finished? And he has enough experience, and he does research on the client and understands the client size and the growth potential and all that stuff to get an idea more or less how much would be the right price range for that customer to feel comfortable with the service provider. And to say that, Kirk and I both, when we talk about value pricing, we talk about scoping and the value conversation as the most important piece. Blair is in this advanced stage where he's, I'm not going to say he's beyond that. I think he still has significant value conversations, but I think he has sort of a value conversation with himself to try to infer what is it that he's doing for that client. And it predetermines that range of pricing just to see whether the client is in that range as well. So whatever idea he has in mind about, you know, how much, I don't want to say effort, but how much value he's bringing to the table, it's congruent or it matches with his original plan. So I think that's kind of what you're saying. So maybe we can contrast that with the value conversation and make that a good segue into let's talk about your session in QuickBooks Connect.
Well, I think what Blair has done essentially is he's become so good at the value conversation that he's actually able to have the value conversation in less time. He knows which part of the value conversation is most important to him. And he's basically able to get that information that he needs in order to create a price, you know, very quickly from the customer. So that's, I actually believe he is having the value conversation. He just knows how to do it, and he knows what part of it is important. And that, as we've said a couple of times, that's a more advanced level. So what's my session at QuickBooks Connect? I don't remember the exact title of it, but it's something along the lines of, it's not enough to get the customer to say yes, you need to know why. And so I think the title of it is The Art of Engaging Customer Dialogue. Essentially, I'm going to be talking about how do you have the why conversation? How do you get into that conversation? And we're going to start from an aspect of you haven't done it before. You're going to be doing this brand new. So if you've never done it before, you're going to be able to walk in and get some tools to help you walk out. In fact, I distill it down to three basic questions that you can use to start. Now, if you're somebody who has maybe been having value conversations, is ready to go to the next level, the good news is it's a 90-minute session. So I'm not going to spend all of it at the beginner's level. We're going to start at the beginner's level, and then we're going to move up to the intermediate and intermediate advanced level. I'm going to have some more things. So it's going to be possibly review for some, and for some it's going to be brand new, but there's going to be something for everybody. We're going to have some demonstrations of it. I'm not just going to get up there and show slides. Of course, if you know me, you know, I go with minimalist slides. I'm not somebody who, you know, sits there and shows 8 bullet points on a slide and then goes to the next slide, slowly reveals each. That's not my style. I tend to teach in an outline. I tend to teach in a structured way, but I'm going to have examples where I demonstrate how to have a value conversation. We'll have at least a couple exercises where those that are in attendance get to participate. So it's going to be a very engaging, active, type of session. And if you know me, I don't tend to stand still. I tend to move around the room. I also tend to include humor in it. In fact, we're even going to talk a little bit about how you can use some techniques from comedy as, you know, kind of fodder for having the value conversation. So there's a lot of things that we're going to be doing in there. And I just continue to refine this session. You mentioned it's a topic I've taught before. I have taught it before. I've never taught it this way before, meaning every time I teach a subject, I always add new information. I always bring something new to it. I never teach it the same way completely twice. I don't have a canned session that's the only way I do it, that I, you know, I can never change. So I'm looking forward to that. What about you? You're doing something around using YouTube as a marketing platform. Tell me about that.
Yeah, can we dig a little deeper into yours before we go into mine?
Sure. I just didn't want to get on the deep end with you because I didn't want you to drown.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I could do mine fairly quickly. So one of the, I know we're talking about Blair Enns, so I'll bring it back into the conversation. One of the lines on his book, the Win Without Pitching Manifesto, is we will do with words what we used to do with visuals or something like that. And you were talking about your teaching style.
See, mm-hmm.
I went to a couple of your sessions. You've actually used me as a prop, which is fine.
By the way, you did a great job of holding the whiteboard. I was so happy with your performance.
Exactly. And you have your slides have like maybe like 50 words and the whole presentation. And usually each of my slides have so I like you show one word or one sentence or a group of words and then create a whole conversation around it, so people are more focused on what's coming out of your mouth rather than distracted by all the bullet points on the screen. And I wanted to recognize I actually like that style very much.
Thank you.
I strive to do that, but then, you know, then I have to put a whole bunch of stuff in the PowerPoint, so I have a tough time getting.
Let me give you a tip. The less words you put on the slide, the less the audience knows when you deviate.
Oh,
that's a professional speaker tip right there.
Actually, that's great.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Actually,
stuff.
Yeah, of course. Because if you got three bullet points there and you mention a fourth, it's like, hey, where did that come from? That's not on the screen. Actually, that's brilliant. I didn't even think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yep.
And thinking about that, so when you are trying to figure out what the client wants in your interaction in the project, and you're trying to dig deep and have this conversation, which is essentially around figuring out priorities, right? Because a lot of times, and let's dig a little bit deep into it, a lot of times where folks try to implement value pricing, especially accountants, they try to, when they come up with the price, they try to have this spreadsheet style mathematical equation and how they got there, just because we are trained that numbers don't come out of nowhere, right? All the numbers are balanced. Every debit has a credit. So when we come up with a price, it's an accumulation of, let's call it value. And that's just it's the wrong approach. And we are so used to things that have to build upon each other in order to come up with a number, that the concept of value pricing, especially when it's implemented wrong, tends to draw people away from it. So what is it about, and you've been already working with accountants for like 5 years or so you have a lot of experience. What is it about the mindset of the accountant that makes it so difficult to understand the value is subjective and it doesn't need to be calculated?
Well, I think you nailed it, right? Accountants are taught that every debit has a credit. But we need to realize that pricing and accounting are two completely different skills, and you don't approach one skill the way you approach the other. Just because they both have numbers does not mean that you approach them both the same way. Let's use a building analogy. Okay, if I'm going to build a home with brick, and then I'm going to build a monument with brick, I don't approach building those the same way. They're completely different things. They may use the same or similar core materials, raw materials, but I don't approach building them the same way. I was watching a movie on how they decided what the Vietnam Memorial in Washington was going to look like. And it's really interesting. They did a contest in how they chose, you know, these, what appear to be these two simple wings of black granite embedded into a hill. My point is, they approached that completely different than they would building a house. You have to do the same thing. Yes, the raw materials of pricing and accounting may appear to be numbers, but you don't use the same skills from accounting with pricing. And so I think that's why there's this mindset. I've said this often, and I'll say it again, and I'll say it in a room with people who disagree with me so we can debate it, because I believe it so strongly. There is no formula for pricing. Anybody who tells you that there's a formula for pricing is just trying to teach you, trying to put you into a rut or a recipe for it. And I think you've got to be more flexible with your pricing. Are there frameworks and blueprints you can work with? Certainly. I teach two or three different frameworks in talking about the value conversation alone, but there is no formula for pricing. You made a comment earlier that I grinned at. You said, you know, numbers don't come out of thin air. Well, not in accounting, but in pricing, yeah, they do. What is thin air? It's this. The gray matter in here is the best pricing tool you have, and you've got to be comfortable using that. Otherwise, you're not going to become a true pricer. You know, there was a Facebook group that we're both in where somebody, you know, I think if I remember right, somebody had attempted to implement value pricing in their business. It hadn't gone well. And so they wrote an article and posted on LinkedIn. And the title of the article was almost like clickbait, right? It was something like value pricing sucks, or, you know, something like that. And anyway, then that article got posted in this Facebook group that you and I are part of. And all of a sudden we got some more information from the author, you know, that basically, okay, you know, I realize I didn't approach it the right way. There's some things I need to learn, et cetera. But, you know, it was kind of one of those things where people who just see that article, see that title, are just going to go, okay, it doesn't work, I'm walking away. Well, it's a soft skill set, okay? Accounting is a hard skill set, the numbers, the debits and credits and stuff, at least much more so. Pricing is not, and we've got to get comfortable with that. And that's one of the things I try to do in my session through the activities is get people comfortable with using their soft skills.
I think a lot of folks, and I would say a big group of people, they hear value pricing or just anyone talking to accountants about pricing, and they see it as a gimmick of some sort, which is kind of strange, because this is just a theoretical framework. I mean, this is not, like, no one's ever said this is right or this is wrong. This is just saying this is probably better. And the theoretical framework, it's very clear. It says most of us, when we buy things anywhere, we have the price up front, with the exception of somehow our accountants and our lawyers, because we have to wait until they tally their time and send us a bill. So it is just bringing that frame of reference to say, how come it doesn't make sense to do that anywhere else, but it does in accounting and law or whatever other industry, it's by the hour. You know, you don't go to the supermarket, buy a can of corn, and then they come back and say, well, you know, the tin can was 10 cents and there was so much labor put into the corn, and then we put so much salt and brine, and like, that doesn't, for some reason, as consumers, we want to equate what we're buying and the price. That's it. It's simple. So that's really what most value pricing folks like yourself, like Ron, that's all they're trying to teach. Now, unfortunately, there are folks like myself and like Kirk that not only that dig a little bit deep and do have sort of packaged knowledge that we sell, right? Whether it's a, you know, a webinar or a private training session, or we get paid to speak at these conferences to talk about these topics. So I think that gets a little bit on the way where people say, well, they're just trying to sell me something. Look, the idea, you don't have to buy anything to be convinced that if your customers are happier, and as a consequence of that, they pay you more, and then you get more money and you're happier. I don't know how anybody can attack that. I mean, that's just such a, it's just a perfect harmony, right? So assuming that you implement value pricing and your customers like the experience better, and assuming that you effectively get more out of it as a practitioner that you would have if you charge by the hour, it's going to be a win-win proposition, right? If none of these things are happening, where you raise your prices for the race of, let me change the topic, because I actually did talk on the phone with that person that posted that article. So if you were to price something higher than your average hourly billing for the month, just for the sake of pricing it higher, and that's it, and that was the only reason you were doing that, well, you did it wrong in the first place, right? And that was what I was trying to explain to him, to say, look, the only reason why you should implement value pricing is because value pricing means that the price matches the value or is under the value of what you provide. That's all it means, which means that in order to get there, you have to understand what the customer values, which means you have to get the client to tell you what's high priority, what's low priority, which also means that you as a practitioner have to figure out if the things that the customer values are also the things that you can provide, which also means that if you are going to provide high value to a customer, you have to quite possibly increase your tooling and your skills. So value pricing as a theoretical framework, well implemented, has this spillover kind of domino effect that it just makes the entire experience better. And then on top of that, if your customer is happy about paying one price you quote up front, and you're protecting your relationship with your customer because you're not having some person from, let's call it, you know, a third world country that can charge a third of what you can. I can probably do the same thing. It probably has enough spare time to do it better. You protect your business that way. So I think if you actually take a look at all the components and the byproducts of the culture behind the value pricing business model, not pricing higher for the sake of pricing higher, I think you see things differently. And unfortunately, I think that the value pricing speakers, I would say, not you, of course, Kirk, not Ron, but some of them, they attach a gimmick of some sort to what they're teaching, like a plan or a system or a spreadsheet, right? And people buy into that tool or that gimmick, and when it doesn't work, then the whole genre of better pricing for industry gets hit. So I know that was a big rant, but I wanted to kind of just summarize how I felt as someone that screwed up on value pricing at the beginning, and then is actually doing better now that I've learned how to implement it better.
So I want to, I'm glad that you actually, so first of all, I want to congratulate you because in this forum, this Facebook forum that we're talking about, you know, you actually reached out and said, hey, you know, I've had some different experience. If you want to contact me, let's talk. And I'm glad to hear that you had a conversation. So obviously, you know, we're not revealing the identity here. But I would like to know more about that conversation. What did you find that, number one, were maybe some misconceptions that we could help correct, you know, in, you know, mindset for people? And also too, what are some things that you suggested to help improve?
Okay. So the case at hand was, and I obviously we didn't sign a non-disclosure agreement, but I'll stay within that realm that some of the conversation is semi-private, right? But yep. The general concept is, this is a big customer that I'm billing on the five figures every month. We have a few high-skilled staff members on it. This customer has been paying us for years an hourly rate, and we've been able to, you know, inflation adjust our hourly rate every year, you know, gone from $125 to $200 an hour in the last 5 years, whatever it has been. And the relationship has worked great. The client has never combated a bill. The client is a sophisticated financial type of client, and they're probably very used to paying lawyers and other accountants an hourly rate. And he admitted that if he would have gone back 3 years ago, we have fixed rated that at something that he felt at the moment was going to be a big number, let's say $15,000, that would have been half or a third of what he's effectively billing every month. So that was the case. And that made me think a little bit. And I told him up front, I said, look, it's hard to defend let's call it value pricing. If the framework is, I've been billing my client for that 3 years, the client's happy to pay for that. They never combated a bill. They have no worry that the client would go anywhere else. That's another thing I told them. I told them the problem with your hourly rate is that anyone could just lower it by $20. And all of a sudden you're very vulnerable, right? Because the only thing you're trading is time. So unfortunately, in that limited framework of that limited circumstance, it's hard to defend value pricing. But the one thing I told them is, you know, have you tried to understand what it would cost a client if your firm wasn't present? Like, this is the why not portion of the why conversation you talk about, right?
What, the cost of doing nothing is what you're describing.
What's the cost of doing nothing? And what if you decide to sell this firm to another CPA group and they're all a-holes and they don't talk to that client well, and the client goes
don't sell.
Out, right? And the client goes out and looks for another firm. You know, think about what position they're going to be. They're going to have to now explain to a new firm their entire business model and what they do and how they do it. They're going to try to convince a new firm to charge the same rate that the old firm that you were charging. And that firm may have now has better information that you have, that you had 3 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, whenever you took the client, about fixing the value price. Because now contextually, the new firm can say, you know what, they were charging you between $25,000 and $35,000 a month for this work. You know, I'm from my experience and looking and judging these 3 years worth of work that you're bringing in the table, I would not charge this hourly. I would charge a flat fee of $50,000. And all of a sudden, you helped another firm fix price and get a bigger amount than you did, because you did the hard work of charging by the hour and creating the framework around it. So that was kind of like my explanation. And at the end of the day, he's like, well, I just don't know how to get out. I don't know how to get out of it, and I'm highly worried that if I do turn around and give them a flat fee, that there's going to be a high level of uncertainty on what needs to be done, and I may end up having to put 3 new staff members on it, and all of a sudden I can't afford, or I will lose some money in the deal. And then we had the conversation, but what about scope? Are you scoping this job? And he says, yeah, we're scoping it. We're scoping it very well, but it's still unknown. And it's like, dude, listen, there's a hole in your conversation here. You can't say I'm scoping the job well, but I still don't know what we need to do. I mean, that's just completely that's just completely off. You know, so without getting, you know, conflicted with him, that was just my point. And yep. I said, hey, dude, you know, hey, you got a new friend that will help you through this process, and as much as I can, you know, if you ask me. But I understand what you mean. Like, don't rattle the cage. If you got one customer that's paying well, probably paying the bills, probably if that customer goes away, he has to fire 2 people immediately. I mean, I understand the worry behind having a high-paying client that's already paying by the hour and transitioning that one. I think Kirk will probably recommend that you start with like the sort of the lower value clients and try to get them up, because if you try to transform this overnight and lose your top 3 clients over it, you're gonna have a tough time paying the bills, right? But I think that was honestly, his concern was, in his perspective, the risk level of transforming his top clients to value pricing would either have 2 negative repercussions. 1, the client leaves, and 2, he underprices and loses money on it. And that's the biggest fear that I think most people have. So it's fair.
So just kind of my comments on those 2 fears. Number 1, we need to call this what it is. It's not just pricing differently. It's changing the business model, okay? I used to call hourly billing a business model. I don't think it's a business model. It is, hourly billing is the decision to operate without a business model, whereas value pricing or pricing or whatever, and by the way, I think I'm going to gradually stop using the term value pricing and just start calling it what it is. It's pricing, okay? Whereas hourly billing is, it's billing, and it's a bad thing anyway. So about pricing, you don't want to change your business model recklessly. You should not put your business in danger. You should not put the livelihood of your employees. You should not put your own livelihood in danger when adopting a new business model. You need to do it cautiously. And so in this Facebook group, I said, you know, there's 3 tips that I would give when switching. Number 1, have a basic understanding of the concepts of pricing. Two, have faith that those concepts are actually true, because you're not going to be able to fully understand everything without experience. So you're going to understand the concepts, and you'll gain greater understanding by gaining experience. And until you have experience, you have to rely on faith. And then number three was have a mentor. It can be, you know, a colleague who does it for free. It could be a mentor or coach you pay. It could just be, you know, Facebook group, Slack group, whatever. But have some way to get feedback and a place to go to ask questions. And that was the one comment he had made was, you know, hey, I would have liked to have had a mentor, you know, now being able to look back and, you know, if I could go back in time, I would have had one, was his comment.
Well, can I jump in on this mentor thing?
Yeah, sure.
I think one of the problems with the word mentor, it's like most people think of someone that has done the exact same thing that I want to do, that is in the peak of their career and success, and is going to show me everything they've done and how they do it. And it's also going to solve the most burning questions I have about understanding my practice best. And that's, most people say, well, that's a mentor, but how do I find one? Look, honestly, you got anyone that's in the peak of their career and they're busy, they're probably not going to lend themselves to do mentorship, especially if it's for free, right? I mean, so that's, I think one of the challenges that people have is, okay, Kirk, I buy the idea. I need a mentor. Well, how do I find one? You know, you can't go to mentor.com and like find one, right? That doesn't work like that. And I don't even know that's a real website. But sometimes a mentor is not one person that knows what they're doing, but it could be another person that will bring light into the answers you already have. And this is what, and that's the principles of coaching. I don't know a lot about coaching, but I do have some coaching clients that have explained to us what, you know, explained to me what coaching means. And in a way, Kirk is one of my mentors, right? We get on a call, we talk about what's on our mind, we bounce each other ideas of each other. In a way, I am sort of a mentor to him, although he's like 50 years older than I am. So I know that feels kind of weird,
I'm going to challenge you to arm wrestling.
Yeah, I think you'll win.
And I'm going to kick your little 30-year-old tail.
I think you'll win. I'll challenge you to a spreadsheet off.
I'll beat you. Gosh.
Okay.
Death by boredom.
But I think that mentorship has this stigma of what it is or what it should be. And sometimes mentorship is just having another person that's maybe on the same, let's call it, level as you are. And once that mutual benefit, and it's a person that you talk to every week, every month, and bounce ideas off, and then compare that and contrast that with maybe the podcast or the books or, you know, the bodies of work that some of these true experts or at least experienced folks are bringing out to the open. Like finding this perfect mentor. Like, by the way, I get emails weekly of people saying, hey, can you mentor me? And it's like, well, you know, what do you have in mind? And then they don't have an answer, right? I mean, like, if you pay me $10,000 a week, I'll mentor you, you know, because I have to spend time, you know, building your business instead of building mine. I mean, that's the problem. That's the real challenge with mentorship, is that the folks that probably have the best ability to help you because they're in the weeds and they're doing all the same things that you want to do, they probably don't have enough time to do this. And some of the folks, once they retire and they have organizations like SCORE, I don't know if you heard of that, Kirk, they have that in Miami, or like SCORE, where you have like retired executives that, you know, that want to give back, let's call it that. And then they sit there and they're literally waiting for someone to say, hey, mentor me. You know, they're probably not what your idea of a mentor was, but I'll bet you that the stuff that you can get from them, it's really great. So that's the thing. I think I agree with you that a mentorship relationship is highly, highly valuable. I think that most folks look for it in the wrong place, or they're waiting for somebody to magically take them under the wing for no reason. And I think that's the challenge. The challenge is that we both agree that having a mentor of some sort or a co-mentor relationship, it's great, but people just don't know how to find it.
So I'm going to push back a little. And that's one of the nice things about this webcast, is the fact that we don't always agree. We don't always have same points of view. And so people can hear both sides of the coin and then, you know, decide which route they want to go. I think how do you find a mentor? You ask. Okay. Now there's more behind that. How you ask. If you walk up, you know, let's say I do a session, okay, on value pricing, and somebody walks up afterwards and, you know, says, "Hi, great session. Hey, would you mentor me?" That's not the best approach. Best approach is, you know, build a relationship with the person first, right? Whether you do that through social media, in person, maybe, a combination of that. My response to that, if somebody says that, I'd say, well, you know what? I've done 120 1-hour mentoring sessions. They're called the Art of Value Podcast, and here's where you find them. But if you build a relationship with somebody, you can then be in a position to, you know, you've earned some trust, you've earned some rapport, you develop rapport, I think is a better way to say it. You can ask for a mentorship, and it could be with a peer, it could be with somebody who teaches it. So I think the first thing is ask. Second, you made the point, and I'll reiterate it, is be prepared to invest some money. It's kind of blows my mind that some people think, all right, I'm going to change my business model, a business model that based on case studies and what people who've been there, done that say, could, you know, double, triple, or even more my revenue, and yet I'm not going to invest any money to hire somebody to help me do that. That's kind of blows my mind that people would think in that way. But I think you can get a mentor. I think you can, and I think you start by asking, but you've just got to be, you know, think about who it is. And the other point that I think you made is valuable is realize they also have their own business. So, you know, some people might be willing to take on one, maybe two, you know, just because they want to do it. But beyond that, somebody's going to want to be paid. So that would be my comment. So I want to transition here. I know we could keep going on this. We're the king of rabbit holes. We need to get a t-shirt that says that.
Right.
But, I want to come back to your session. So what is your session? Tell me about that.
So my session, by the way, they picked the title. So I kind of work around that. I knew what the theme was.
Me too.
Yeah. They picked the title. I knew what the theme was, but they picked the title. So, you know, the theme was, hey, I'll teach something about video marketing because it's something that I've done for, you know, several years, and there isn't that many other accountants doing it. So I'm probably a good person to look up to for advice on that. Although I'm definitely not an expert at it. I'm more of an accountant than a video marketing person. But so they're calling it effective video making effective videos for your marketing. I think it's what it is. I'll double check with the website, because obviously I don't think the title matters anyway at this point. If it's got video marketing or something like that attached to it, it's got my name next to it, I think that people can infer pretty much what it is. But I think it's effective video marketing. But the point is, I kind of like when they come up with the name, just because it allows me to adjust a little bit instead of making it the same old thing. I'm still looking for it, but I think it's effective video marketing. I don't see it on the website anymore, but it's effective video marketing. And actually, hold on a second. Sorry.
I think the title was YouTube. There's gold in them thar video cameras.
Right. Here it is. So sorry. I had to have people watch me surf through a website. Okay. So it's called Creating Effective Marketing Videos. Okay. That was close. And because I waited for that title and they came up with the title, I actually changed my approach this year. So every year I've taught, hey, this is how you make a video. This is the components that you should have in a video. And this is how you post it. And this is why it's valuable to have videos as marketing source. That has been always the message, right? Now that they're calling it creating effective marketing videos, I'm actually going to change the approach. And my approach is about, well, what is effectiveness when it comes to video marketing, right? So it's not just about people now being inspired to create a video. I think people should be inspired, if they're going to get into video, to talk about what effectiveness is. And I'll break it down. We have about 10 minutes or so. So I'll see how much I can cover from it. So effectiveness from a video would be getting, I'll say at the most simplest level, is getting someone to watch it, right? If people don't watch it, then obviously it has zero potentiality to be effective, right? So people, at the end of the day, the video needs to drive new business, right? That's ultimately what effectiveness is. The problem is there's multiple layers and steps to get there. So the first thing of being effective is getting people to watch it, right? So I'm going to talk about what gets people to watch it. So we'll talk about discoverability, so how to do basic research in YouTube to find out what's trending, what are people searching for. So hopefully through just simple search, they can find your topic. I will talk a lot about being hyper specialized, whereas I prefer that three potential buyers watch my video than a million random people watch my video. And the point is that unless I'm making money off ads or something like that, which is another business model, so I'll discuss that briefly because I don't want to talk too much about that, just because I've spent 5 years and I make, you know, a couple bucks from video ads, from ads and advertising. And I don't think was my intention in the first place. And that's not what I want. I actually want clients to call me from YouTube, which is really what happens in real life. And that's why my YouTube channel is so valuable. But anyway, so the first layer of effectiveness is getting people to watch it, which means getting it discovered and using hyper topics that there isn't other videos on. Like anybody can make a video about how to reconcile the banks in QuickBooks, right? The problem is you're going to compete with 30 other videos. But if somebody says, how to reconcile my bank in QuickBooks for a farming business, right? Your video may be the only one. Again, you're making a narrow statement about the video and who is it for. Although most accountants would argue that it's the same, it doesn't matter what type of business it is. But customers don't know this. Like, customers don't know that reconciling a bank or a financial statement or a balance sheet or inventory is the same for a farming business than for a manufacturing business or for a, you know, wholesaler business. So when you make a video and you use examples that don't relate to your customers don't have an accounting background. So they're automatically going to think, oh, this is for a different type of business. This is not for me. So you may need to go narrow to find more effectiveness in actually getting the folks that you want to open up their wallets and send you money to watch. So that's some, I'm going to talk about that and discoverability and just doing some general research to figure out what topics to use. So that's one level of it, right? So just getting people to click, getting people to watch. That's layer one. And Kirk, if I was coaching you on video, this is exactly what I would be teaching you. The second layer would be, okay, so you got someone to click. Great. We got over that very difficult task is to get someone to click, right? It's like, kind of like get customers in the store. Now we need to make sure that people watch the entire video or at least get to the point until your call to action, it's there, right? The effectiveness when it comes to the watching part of the video is, you know, did your message transmit? Did the person understand what you were trying to say? And are the next steps clear? And if the next steps are to call you or contact you, is that path simple, right? Like if your next step is go to my website and contact me, and then you go to your website and it takes like 8 clicks to find the phone number, obviously there's something very ineffective about the way you're doing this process, right? So we have to now think about during the video itself, during the content, what does effectiveness mean? What do you want the client to get out of that video? Do you want them to call you? You want them to email you? Do you want them to remember you? So when they do call you a year later, they remember who you are, what you stand for, and have a higher probability of buying from you. Or do you want them to remember you as the expert? So they're not ready to buy now, but when they're ready to buy 3 years from now, they're okay with paying 3 times the price because it's already in their subconscious that you're the man or you're the woman for the job. So that's the second level of it, is how do we create effectiveness around the viewable portion of it, right? And then I'm going to show you some tools in YouTube where you can actually see something called a drop-off, where you get stats around when people are logging off. And you can use that information if you see a pattern where you see a big dip on when people like stop watching your video. Find out what you said, how you said it, if there was some issue with the noise or quality, or maybe you ranted off to some other topic. Find out what is turning people off from your video. So when you make the new one, you adjust from that. So that would be like, that's that piece. And then we'll talk about effectiveness after the video, which is how do you use your video platforms to improve all other aspects of your business or create new service streams. So I'll give you one interesting one is I do one-on-one training sessions with QuickBooks and I charge a price. And we ask the client, do you want a recorded copy that doesn't go into YouTube, right? A private recorded copy. And they say, yes, that's an extra $100. And all I had to do is click a button, record, and send it to charge an extra $100. All of a sudden, I'm increasing 20, 25% of my revenue with a single client because they find having a recorded, a recording of that valuable. Now, that's inferred that we're not allowed to record the session. So when the client tells me, hey, I want to record your session, I tell them no. Now, I can't prevent them if they're recording it otherwise, but most people are respectful towards it. I say, no, that's not a recorded session. Why is a recorded session more expensive than a non-recorded session? You would ask, especially if you're not a value pricer. You would say, well, the effort is the same, right? So why is that costing any more? Well, if you're being recorded and you're a professional that holds a license and you're watching TV, you're watching, you know, the news, what you say and how you say and how you practice can be held against you, you know, if you're being recorded, right? So you have to think about, so I have to up my game a little bit. I have to maybe add more disclaimers. It is possible that something that takes 5 minutes to explain because it has no ifs or buts around it, right? Or no disclaimers or no general rule, no exception to the rule. I have to be a little bit more lengthy, more explainful. I don't know if that's a word. I have to be more explainful and maybe have to cite my work too. I have to say, okay, based on what you're telling me, this is what I think you should do. And by the way, let me search it real quick. Let me send you a link of the IRS website that supports what I'm saying. So there's just a lot more work around being recorded. And the client needs to understand that. And the client does value that. So you charge a little bit more for it. So that's something that recording YouTube videos inspired me to add as an additional service. And I would say only 15 to 20% buy it. But the ones I do, they love it. It's like a personal, coach, you know, in their computer. And you were talking about mentorship. So you get, so what are the things that your YouTube channel can inspire your business to do? The other piece that it has done is I have I have great body of work now. So when I talk to a new client that's manufacturing, I tell them before we meet, you must watch these two videos, videos I've already done in manufacturing. And most people say, well, you're shooting yourself in the foot, Hector. You're explaining a lot of the stuff you would have explained in your private training session. Yeah, I know. But I know that I charge double, triple what the next guy charges. And I only want to deal with the difficult stuff, the challenging stuff. And I want to be the one that solves the big expensive problems rather than helping someone how to create an inventory item. I prefer that they learn that through my video first. And that inspires them to ask the smarter, deeper, harder questions during my session. And that makes it much harder for me to be a commodity, right? Because anyone can explain the basics and anyone can charge to explain the basics, but not a whole bunch of people get in the deep end of the complicated portion of, let's say, manufacturing or inventory. So I'm okay with giving away, you know, 3-4 hours worth of videos that explains the basics that probably shoots myself in the foot of what would have been a 3-day training. Now it's only 1 day or a 2-day training, but I adjust my prices so I can afford to spend time creating basic content so I can charge more delivering advanced content. So that would be the third phase, is how we use those videos to have an effective practice around it. So it also feels like it was worth the investment to do the whole thing. So that was it in 8 minutes. Hopefully I covered it all. I don't know if I went too long on that.
So Hector, I'm just glad to know that you're not overly excited about your topic. That I appreciate that. So, let's wrap this up by doing this. If somebody has been enthused or excited or empowered by us discussing the sessions we're going to be doing and they want to join us, where should they go to join us in San Jose, California in early November for QVC?
Okay, so there's a caveat to this, Kirk. Caveat number one, both of us are teaching at the same time. So you are going to have to make a choice. I think so. Or not. No. So I'm doing Monday, November 5th at 1:30 p.m. in San Jose, California at QuickBooks Connect. So you go to www.quickbooksconnect.com, register for the conference. You will get all the value from my session, and then everything else you get as a bonus. And then Kirk's session, which I thought it was at the same time as me, because we almost always, they put us in conflicting sessions, but I don't know if yours is at the same time. Do you know what time is yours?
3:00. So People can get warmed up with your session, then come to my session. I'll finish knocking them out and then go have supper.
And is yours on Tuesday or on Monday?
Monday at 3.
Monday at 3. Okay. I don't see it on the calendar, but what is it called? 3:30.
It's the Art of Engaging Customer Dialogue.
Okay. That's at 3:30. Yep. It's called Yes and the art of engaging customer dialogue at 3:30. I'm definitely going to attend that one and not attend the blockchain one, which is the other one.
You're not going to make it to mine. You're going to be too busy answering questions for yours. I just hope ours are not in the same room, because then I won't start on time, because people will still be trying to get their questions answered. Yours.
That's a good point. So definitely that. I think Kirk, you get there on Sunday. Is it Sunday that you get there?
I am flying in Monday morning. I looked at my schedule and I looked at airfare prices, and I'm going to be getting in about 8 to 9 o'clock California time.
Okay. See, I'm getting there on Saturday and midday. I may go to San Francisco just to eat something delicious and then come back to San Jose. And on Sunday, I may do something fun, like go play golf or something. We'll see what happens. So I'm relaxed for my session. But yeah, I will be in QuickBooks Connect hanging around, and my class would be at 1:30 p.m. And then on Tuesday, I have no classes to teach so far, so I'll probably be hanging around different classes, and I'll come back Tuesday night. I elected not to stay there through Wednesday. I got 4 kids to take care of. So,
well, and see, that's where our trade-off is. You're coming in Saturday, leaving Tuesday. I'm coming in Monday morning, leaving Wednesday night, because I have a couple sessions Wednesday morning. So
right.
Either way, so if you want to join us, I think it's just qbconnect.com. Otherwise, Google QB Connect or QuickBooks Connect. We'll see you in early April in November.
Absolutely. Thank you.